This is Global Torah, conversations and meditations on global Jewish service and international development. The series is brought to you by Olam, a joint platform for promoting global Jewish service, and the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Shani Rosenbaum, your host and program manager at Olam. In this series, we'll be exploring the intersections between Jewish text, Jewish life, and global service. How do we approach challenges like global hunger and extreme poverty as Jews? What do our traditions, historical experiences, and communal conversations have to contribute toward the practice of international development? And why, as Jews, do we care about global issues? On each episode of Global Torah, you'll hear a conversation between scholars of Jewish text and tradition and Jewish practitioners of global service. Our guests are tackling challenges ranging from supplying solar energy in Rwanda to empowering youth leaders in Nepali villages to providing disaster relief in the Philippines. In today's episode, we ask, what's text got to do with it? How do we approach Jewish text when addressing modern global social issues? Where do our texts align with modern trends and ethics in international development sector? Where do our texts diverge from those trends? Do we believe Torah, Jewish text and tradition, has something unique and valuable to contribute to conversations about serving communities in need? And if we do think Torah has something to offer, where and how can we access it? Here with us to discuss these questions from their own experiences as both scholars and practitioners are Rabbi Dr. Mish Hammer Kassoy, Director of the Social Justice Track of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, Danielle Abraham, co-chair of the Israeli Designed International Development Network, and Rabbi Yedidia Julian Sinclair, Vice President of the Israeli solar energy company Energia Global. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to start off our conversation by getting a sense of what role Jewish text and text generally plays in our everyday life and in our work. And so I wanted to ask actually each of you, is there a specific text, either Jewish or not Jewish, that has changed how you think or behave in the world? And what's that text? Mish, go for it.
One of the Gemarot, the passages from the Talmud that I love to teach, is this passage in Nedarim, in the Gemara of Nedarim, I think it's 80b, where there's a debate between the sages and Rabbi Yossi about what to do if you don't have enough money or food or water, as the case is in this particular passage, to feed both yourself and your neighbors. And how do you prioritize? Everyone agrees that you get to drink first, but then what happens if you don't have enough for you and your own animals as well as your neighbors? And the sages take the position that your neighbors get to drink before your animals get to drink, where Rabbi Yossi takes the position that your animals get to drink and you can let your neighbors die of thirst. And it's really just an unbelievable passage. It's how could Rabbi Yossi say such a difficult thing? And by the way, that's the way the traditional halakha decides, and which is so disturbing. The only reason I can handle it is because Isi ben Yehuda is in the Beit Midrash at the time, and he goes ballistic just as I would have, and drops right out, says, I can't possibly learn with Rabbi Yossi because he has no morality. And later, you can come to understand on some reflection that, or Vardimus, Rabbi Yossi's son, helps us understand that actually, if you don't take care of your animals, you won't be able to take care of your long-term needs. And so you don't have to, what Rabbi Yossi is suggesting is that we have the right, maybe even the responsibility, to take care of our long-term needs as well as our short-term needs. And when I learned this Gemara for the first time, and also when I teach this Gemara, it's so deeply offensive. It's really very, very difficult. I identify very much with Isi ben Yehuda. But then I start to realize about myself that not only do I take care of my long-term needs before I provide for other people's immediate and desperate needs, I even buy myself a Starbucks sometimes. I go out to dinner. I go to the movies. And holding that mirror up to my own priorities while I'm busy judging someone else has really helped me, first of all, think more complexly about setting priorities, but also be more generous with my own funds. And so that's a text that's been very, very instructive for me.
Thanks. Danielle, is there a text that speaks to you, that informs the way you live?
There is, actually. And when I first heard the question, I wanted to challenge us to broaden our horizons about what we mean when we say Jewish texts and refer not just to those that are part of the rabbinic tradition, but actually those that have come from modern leaders and the visionaries that have been very active in building the state of Israel, whether that's Herzl or David Ben-Gurion. And as a relatively new Olah, I made Aliyah to Israel 5 years ago from England. I came for a job at Meshav, which is Israel's Agency for International Development in the Foreign Ministry. And one day I went downstairs to the library and I picked up the Israeli government yearbook from 1961. And it opens with the most fascinating essay written by David Ben-Gurion called Towards a New World, Likrat Olam Chadash. And in that essay, he really speaks to the value of international development. And I can quote him what he says. He says, "For Israel, development cooperation is both a moral and a political issue. And from both aspects, Israel must look upon such aid as a historic mission." And I think that quote really sums up all my work here in Israel as both doing it on behalf of the state of Israel as a political entity and a national state, but also as a moral issue. And I know there's sometimes conflict between the two. Do we put the politics first, or is it actually the moral part and the Jewish values which are driving us? And I will have to say that I come down on the side of Golda Meir that said, while she recognizes there is both realpolitik and tikkun olam and Jewish values, that the driving one is the Jewish values and the moral aspect. So that's what really drives my work at the moment.
Thanks. And Yedidia, is there a text that informs the way you do your work?
Well, there's a text that I encountered before Jewish text really became important to me, which did help me get on this track of working in international development that I'm on now. It's a text which I first paid attention to shortly after graduating from university, and I was sitting in synagogue on Yom Kippur. At that point, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I thought, should I get a job in management consulting like all my friends were doing, or should I? I thought maybe of going to do something in the third world. I'd traveled in Mexico and I thought maybe I could do that, go back there and do something useful. And I was also thinking of going to Israel, maybe studying in yeshiva. In short, I was all over the place. I didn't know what I was doing. And I was up at night thinking about it. And so I was sitting in synagogue on Yom Kippur morning. And we got to the Haftorah, which is from Yeshayahu, Isaiah chapter 58. And he's talking there about what's the point of fasting and what's the point of Yom Kippur. What are we supposed to be doing on that day? And he says, is it about just beating your chest and being hungry and saying, oh, look how religious I am because I look how pious I am? He said, no, that's not the point. The point is that out of this experience, you should reach out and give your bread to the hungry, and you should bring the oppressed poor into your house, and you should care about the needy. And then God will answer you, and then you'll call and he'll say, here I am. And it was a moment where what I was reading, which I'd never paid attention for, like suddenly, collided with what I'd been thinking about in nonstop for the last 2 months, and it just made everything clear. And I thought, yes, this is what I have to do. And so I turned around to my dad, who was sitting next to me, and said, Dad, I'm going to go to Mexico, which is where I ended up going. My dad wasn't too happy about that, but it was just a moment of clarity and meeting between this 2,500-year-old text and what I was thinking about most intensely in my life at that point. And so I went to Mexico, and it really did change my life.
Yedidia, can I ask you a question about that passage, which is probably one of the most beautiful passages in the Bible, ends with, and don't ignore your flesh and blood relatives. And I wonder where the priority is supposed to be placed on taking care of your own poor. Many people, when I do look beyond the walls of my community, say, why are you worrying about them? There are poor Jews or there are poor people here in Israel. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think there's definitely force in that argument. There are many poor people here and we do have a responsibility to them. From my personal experience, I found that going to Mexico, and I ended up working with street children in Mexico City, and like horrifically abused and neglected children who'd just been through the most awful things in their life. And the place where I worked really saved them and brought them to a place where they could, you know, go out and live happy, fulfilled, purposeful lives after these horrific things had happened to them. And I felt that, you know, encountering such deep need has probably helped me be more sensitive to need anywhere. And I also think that, you know, it opened me up to, you know, to suffering of all different kinds. But there was a Catholic priest who ran this organization for street children, and he said about people who came to volunteer, like, they come thinking they're going to be redeemers, and they end up themselves being redeemed, he said. And so I think it just changed me in a way which was, you know, I think helped me be more helpful to, you know, to Jews and not just to, you know, to Mexicans 3,000 miles away.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Anything you wanted to add to that, Danielle?
Yes, I just heard in your question there, Mish, about the point that we hear often here is why should we help people outside of our country if there are enough needy people here? And I think to add to the point of what you just said was relativity and the instance that different kinds of poverty can be seen as relative. I mean, I'm originally from London, so maybe in London, to be poor in London might mean you don't have a television or perhaps only get 2 meals a day instead of 3. But sometimes in the developing world, it could mean that you don't get any meals and you're really fighting for survival. So I think in arguing why we have to look at both where we live in Israel and also abroad is the point of relative poverty. And I would also add to that, and I think in an era of increased globalization, where the poverty is seen and it's so easily visible on our TV screens, on our social media, that it's very hard to say, actually, I'm not a citizen of the world. I'm actually just a citizen of one country. And if you think about the ethics of responsibility that Judaism puts out there, who do we think of ourselves as? Just as a single member of the Jewish community or actually of the global community? And I think that speaks a lot to the argument to not just look inwards, but also outwards. And it's not mutually exclusive. We can do both.
I think if I can add to that, I think the Jewish texts do insist that we pay attention to the people close to us and aniyei kodem, the poor of your city come first. But I think part of what's behind that is that they're insisting that, you know, part of your ethical personality is that when you see things right in front of you, you should respond to them and not avert your eyes and just pay attention to things far away. And today, as you said, Danielle, you know, global problems are right in front of us on our TV screens, in our living rooms, on our computer screens. And so I think in the same spirit, we can't ignore them and pretend and say, oh, you know, I just my physical city I have to care about. We're also part of a global city or village as well. And we can't close our eyes to what's happening there.
One of the traditions, the refrains, I think, in our Jewish tradition that inspires me very much is this idea of not just an ethic of not doing wrong, but also not ignoring, not closing our eyes. There's this, God hears the cry and we have to hear the cry. We can't turn away and pretend we didn't see. We can't stand idly by our neighbor's blood. This understanding that it's so easy to ignore what's going wrong, but God knows we saw, and we can't close our eyes and pretend otherwise. I think that's a very powerful message.
And I think that also poses an additional challenge in today's world, that you see there's so much suffering and poverty in the world, and you can't close your eyes to it because it's constantly in front of you, is I wonder what the halakha or the Jewish texts say about how do you prioritize where to go? Is it in terms of the greatest need? Or is it perhaps start with a look internally and saying, well, what can I offer? And is it about the impact you can create and about the added value that you bring? I mean, how do we choose where to start? Which country, which population, which challenge?
The halachic, the Shulchan Aruch has a lot to say about this question, right? Yadija has already suggested that the poor of our city come first, but then how do we decide that? How do we prioritize? Because it says the poor of your city come first. And in the same quote, it says, and the poor come before the less poor. And how do we balance, since the poor of our city are not necessarily the most poor? And there's a lot of different answers in tradition to that question. The Aruch HaShulchan asks the question. He says, if we always put our poor relatives first, we'll never get beyond our poor relatives because our poor relatives always need something. Ask your children. There's always needs out there. We've never satisfied all of our needs. We always need one more college class, one more skirt. There's no way to be without it. And the Aruch HaShulchan says, it's impossible that we could possibly behave in that way. The Pitchei Tshuva and the Chatam Sofer offer a similar answer to this question, which is this idea of ta'av ta'av kodem, the person with the greatest need comes first. So when we say that that your neighbors come first or your family comes first, that's for them to get firsts on bread and firsts on water. And then after everyone gets a piece of bread and a piece of water, then we can talk about everyone getting an apple. And after everyone has an apple, we send everyone to first grade. And when everyone's gone to first grade, everyone should get second grade. That's not the only answer that's in the codes. But I think that's one answer that's very interesting. The Aruch HaShulchan suggests different answers. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, who is the great halachic ruler of our generation in America, talks about this idea of a gift of significance, that you can choose where you can make your gift of significance to something that has a specific pull to you, that has a place where you think you can make a contribution, where you can make an impact, rather than demanding, even though we have guidelines in the Torah about what you should eat first if you have a plate of olives and a plate of grapes in front of you, how you should decide which one to make the blessing on first. In the context of giving charity, there's a certain amount of room for deciding where you personally can make a contribution, because each of us have different gifts to bring and different pulls, and there's actually room for some of that discretion in Jewish law, which I think is beautiful.
I find this to be a really interesting test case of the kind of thing we're talking about here, the question of how or in what way Jewish texts can inform our conversations about giving, about development, about service in the broader world when it comes to global social issues. I'm curious sort of to pick apart a little bit of what we've talked about here. Danielle, you mentioned the question of relativity, right? Of sometimes one of the metrics we can use to decide where we want to put our energies and our resources is where's the most need. So maybe my neighbor down the street in Jerusalem may be suffering, may be struggling, but I know that there's a child in Ethiopia who may not survive till the next day without my resources be devoted in their direction. So that's how we might make that kind of decision. And it sounds like, Mish, you're adding that, yeah, that same conversation happens in the Shulchan Aruch. What I'm curious about here is, I actually might want to pose this to you, Danielle. When you hear Mish say that same conversation happened in the Shulchan Aruch, does that add to your understanding or to the conversation you've already had internally, kind of without having encountered the Shulchan Aruch's opinion on that?
It definitely makes me more inquisitive and curious to learn more. Mm. And I think I might follow that up actually afterwards, after this conversation with Mish. I mean, I definitely have what I thought was strong clarification and understanding about the idea of relative poverty and really the issue of comparative advantage, which is spoken a lot about a lot when we talk about doing effective development cooperation. If everyone should really focus on an area in which they have comparative advantage, which the State of Israel has been very strong at doing since its establishment and when it started its international development work, focusing on areas such as agriculture and irrigation, where they really developed expertise. And today, where we're looking at exporting or sharing our knowledge about the high tech and the startup nation and how technologies can help with development challenges. So I feel like I have a great clarification on that, but perhaps I don't. And perhaps it's time to really challenge that and really look at the text and see whether there's something more to learn or more nuances that I could take from the text and really apply it back to my everyday work.
So text, encountering Jewish text in the context of global social issues for you is an opportunity to kind of challenge yourself in terms of what you know, what you've thought about, or maybe shake yourself up.
Ah, definitely. I think it's a bit too arrogant to think that we know everything and that I've clarified everything and I'm all ready to go. I think it's great to be challenged, great to think about it. And I'm sure there is so much richness and depth to some of the texts that could really inform and help me reshape and reconfigure what I already know to be true. So I look forward to doing that, Mish.
Me too.
I'm Shani Rosenbaum, and this is Global Torah. You're listening to Rabbi Dr. Mish Hamer Kassoy, Director of the Social Justice Track of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, Danielle Abraham, co-chair of the Israeli Designed International Development Network, and Rabbi Yedidia Julian Sinclair, Vice President of the Israeli solar energy company Energia Global. Yedidia, I'm curious if there are any texts that have spoken to a specific issue or challenge that you've dealt with in your work that have informed the way you approached that challenge.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is that in our company, we're working on a large project on a certain African country. I can't say which because it's a country where the Israel connection would not be terribly helpful. But in the context of a big solar project, we're doing an ambitious CSR, corporate social responsibility project, where we're going to essentially build a village for people who live in the vicinity of the project with better housing and clean water and sanitation and electricity and healthcare, and they don't have any of those things at the moment. They're among the poorest people in the world. And we talk to them and consult with them a lot about what they would like and what they feel they need and what's lacking in their lives. And just by the way, I mean, something which is astonishing in the Jewish sources is how much they stress the importance of the person you're trying to help participating in their better future, and talking to them and listening to them and doing it in a way which doesn't embarrass or humiliate them. It's really astonishing. And that's something that's become prominent in international development in the last 15, 20 years or so. But before that, it was very top-down, paternalistic, build big projects, everybody will benefit, and it didn't work out at all. So there's something that Jewish texts have understood for a long time about the need to get, you know, to get the poor involved in shaping their own future. But a specific thing which came up for me in the work in this country, which was astonishing, is that we asked the people there, who are very traditional Muslims, about what kind of houses they want and what kind of layout for their village they want. The kind of layout that they want is like they have at the moment, which is they have houses grouped around a central courtyard area where communal life takes place. It's a very community-centered way of life, and they want their urban planning to reflect that. And also in terms of the houses and the design of their design, they tell us it's very, very important that the windows be high enough so that people can't just look into your houses from outside, because that would be immodest if they could do that. And both of those things are things that I've encountered in the first chapter of Gemara Bava Batra, which talks exactly about what Jewish urban planning and housing design looks like, or at least looked like in that time in Bavel, in the time of the Gemara, and before that in the land of Israel, in the time of the Mishnah. And it's just been astonishing to me that that I recognize the way those spiritual sensibilities inform their models of urban planning and housing design in a way in which these people in Africa want us to reflect in what we're trying to build for them. So, you know, it's helped me realize that this sensibility is familiar to me from Jewish texts, even though I'm meeting it for the first time in this community.
So what I hear there is a real sense that being immersed in an ancient tradition that's also very sort of ethically and values-based and a spiritual tradition has helped you to connect to the people you're working with. And a little bit I hear in that it connects back to the first thing you mentioned, that you want to make sure you're involving the community in the conversation and meeting them kind of on their level, and that it's not a top-down approach. And one, I think, a really powerful way to do that is to be able to access within your own spiritual tradition something that parallels their needs and values.
Yeah, exactly. That's just what I was trying to say.
I think it's actually quite incredible if you said that the Jewish text, which had obviously been written before international development as we know it started, actually explained there that we shouldn't see them as recipients, as passive objects in this development process, but as actually active subjects that have a voice, and they say, we are your partner in this development endeavor, because I think the world could have learned a lot from the Jewish texts then, because it's taken, as you said, a long time and many decades for the development world to really change their approach from saying, I am the donor, I therefore know best, you are the beneficiary or the recipient of my aid, I'm going to come in and do this. And to really change that paradigm, and I think maybe if we'd have been a bit smarter and looked at the Jewish texts first, we could have actually learned a lot.
I appreciate the celebration of what Jewish text has to offer, and I'm going to throw a wrench in it a little bit, because I'm curious if any of you or each of you have had moments where you've encountered texts that really kind of miss the mark in your view on what it means to engage in the best possible way with development issues, with global service issues. Is there a text you feel really misses the point when it comes to the work that you do? And what do you do when you encounter that kind of text? What does it offer? Does it offer anything? Are we stuck?
I'll take that. I'd like to learn with my children. It was one of the great pleasures in life. And Jewish tradition tends to have a little bit of suspicion about the foreign nations, a little bit of concern about non-Jews and to what extent they can be trusted. I sat down with my son. We're learning Sefer HaChinuch, which goes through all of the commandments in the Torah one by one. And I said straight up to him, wow, I'm a little bit nervous about this commandment. We were learning about the mitzvah to, really not a mitzvah for children, the mitzvah to wipe out the seven Canaanite nations. And I said to him, I'm very concerned. And he said, Ima, don't worry, it'll be you never know what he'll say. And in fact, he did. The Sefer HaChinuch proposed a beautiful explanation for why, on the one hand, God wants to wipe out the seven nations. He wants us to wipe out the seven nations. Why did God create the seven nations in the first place? And suggested that sometimes even the few good that will come out of those seven nations can outweigh the bad that emerges from the wicked people from amongst those nations. And I felt a little better. And then we got to the next mitzvah, which was not to have mercy on the seven nations, not to admire the seven nations. And my son said, I'm not going to like this mitzvah, Ima. This is not a good mitzvah. And I think, first of all, that it's very good to have that dialogue and to be able to bring our own moral compass to those texts, and also to know that we can look and find things that are meaningful within those difficult mitzvot, and to know that there's a very long 2,000 years tradition of reinterpreting those texts and bringing strong interpretations to those texts, as well as modesty. It's very, very difficult, I think, for us in this day and age to be able to say there is evil in the world. And I think being pushed, perhaps, to feel that there is evil in the world and to acknowledge it, and to think that sometimes we have to set firm limits in distancing ourselves from that evil, perhaps pushes us at some times to do that. And sometimes we push back at the text, too. And I think that that clarifying mission of looking with, of struggling with the text. Daniela said earlier that the idea of raising questions is a deeply Jewish idea, and I really appreciated that comment.
Something I've been hearing is something you've been saying throughout is the power of text to both kind of push you out of your comfort zone, even on a values level, that we come very comfortable in the values we have, and so sometimes to shake us a little bit, but also can be clarifying. What you mentioned before, the text that sort of made you feel very angry, and then you realize, well, actually, I see myself in it, and sort of holding a mirror to where we might actually, something that makes us angry coming out of the text, we may want to look to see if it's present in ourselves, and that can clarify for us where we might want to correct our own behavior.
Absolutely.
Fabulous. Anyone else have a response to what happens when the text misses the mark? Where can we go from there?
I'm not sure if I can think of specific texts where I feel that happens. I mean, if I do, I tend to move on to the next text and then, but I can think of...
Short answer. Move on.
But just because there's so many. I mean, but I do feel sometimes that there are approaches to text which I think don't seem to be so helpful. You know, sometimes you do see a very strong kind of reading in of what we already think from Jewish texts, as if Jewish texts are just a kind of a label which we slap onto things that we already know to be true, and don't let ourselves be surprised and don't let us the text teach us anything new. I find that approach first tends to be boring, and second, it's sort of demeaning to Jewish texts to just treat them as a kashrut stamp for what we already think. You know, I've got a friend who doesn't think that Jewish texts can teach us very much about these things, and he always says, "Can it teach me something I don't know already?" And I think that's quite a good test. Maybe also something which maybe I half know already, and then it says it better than I could. And then on the other hand, sometimes you have approaches which dictate a very prescriptive approach from Jewish texts. This is what the texts say we're supposed to do, and so we have to do it. And sometimes those approaches seem to be too formalistic and don't pay attention enough to the reality in front of our eyes. So I think the kind of approaches which I find most helpful are when we bring the whole of our world to study text and willing to listen to the whole of their world and to really take it seriously and be willing to be surprised by it.
I find that dialogue can be so very meaningful, and sometimes there's models in the text that are really push me to aspire and to be a better version of myself, even though I might know that it's a right thing to do. The introduction of the Mesilat Yesharim, Rav Lazzato says, "I'm not telling you anything you don't already know in this book, but you still need to read the book every day because it reminds you of the things you need to do." And that echoes very much for me. I think that I need, it helps me to see beautiful models and to see inspirational models and to try to integrate those things into my life. Even though I knew before that they were the right thing to do, it can remind me to focus on them.
I think this question is actually very relevant for me right now as I embark on my own personal journey to learn more about Jewish text and how it informs what I'm doing today. And there's two points actually I've been thinking about. One, as Misha said earlier, that what I find wonderful about the Jewish tradition isn't that we will sit quietly and accept everything that we read or that we're told. Actually, we celebrate the fact that we can question and challenge and think about and argue and struggle and wrestle with the text. So if I start on my learning journey and I read something that perhaps is uncomfortable for me or which I really disagree with or is not politically correct, as we might term it today, that doesn't scare me in the slightest. Actually, I think it's exciting to be able to read it critically and say, well, what do I do with that? Do I reinterpret it? Do I disregard it and carry on because it doesn't resonate with my moral compass? And the other thing, what Yedidia just said before, about it's not very helpful to look at the text and then just apply it and say, oh, that fits what I'm doing right now. I'll just copy and paste it as you do in a Word or Excel document onto my activities today. I also think that's probably quite unhelpful and also boring. But actually to read it critically and to see, does it challenge what I already think or can it enrich my thoughts? If that's already what I think, is there something new to learn from that text or to aspire to in that sense?
Phenomenal. Thank you all so much. This has been so enriching for me. I feel like we've created our own text here that I'm walking away with a lot of unique learning from. I'm curious if I'm a Jewish person interested in development work and I'm looking for Jewish texts, I'm looking for a place to start to enter the conversation on global Jewish service. Where might I start?
I'll recommend Rabbi Jonathan Sacks' To Heal a Fractured World. It's such a beautiful book and a great starting point. I think Michael Walzer, Exodus to Revolution, excellent, another excellent book.
I would say that if, like me, you're actually coming less from the traditional rabbinic text tradition and actually would like to think in terms of more recent Jewish history, there's actually a vast wealth of texts there from some of our leaders, such as Herzl, who wrote a lot and actually did write about our relationship with Africa. He talked about after he sees the redemption of his own Jewish people, he would like to be active in the redemption of the Africans. And Ben-Gurion obviously wrote about this extensively, as did Golda Meir. And that, where I am today, has really helped shape my vision of Israel and the Jewish people and my role in it.
I'd say if you're in Israel, then enroll in Misha's class in Pardes at the Jewish Social Action Program.
You can come to Israel.
Yeah, even better.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much for your time and your insight.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Shani.
And that's our episode. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for upcoming episodes featuring Dayano Ginsberg, Rabbi Danny Landes, Micha Odenheimer, and more. Global Torah is made possible through partnership between the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies and Olam. Special thanks to Rabbi Dr. Mishhammer Kassoy, Dayano Ginsberg, Louise Scherb, Ben Wallach, and Seth Samuel. And of course, to our guests, Danielle Abraham and Rabbi Yedidia Julian Sinclair. Olam is a joint venture of the Alliance for Global Good, Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation, and Paris Foundation. You can learn more and hear this episode again at pardes.org.il and olamtogether.org.